11:55. Almost midnight. Enough time for one more story.
Ahoy, mateys. This is Stevie Wayne, your nightlight. And KAB, Antonio Bay, California, is on the air.
It's April 21st, and a happy birthday for Antonio Bay.
And keep a watch out for that fog bank heading in from the east.
Fog bank out there. There's a fog bank out there.
This town sits around for 100 years and nothing happens, and then one night the whole place falls apart.
Blake followed our false fire on shore, and his ship broke apart on the rocks off Spivey Point. Blake's gold will be recovered tomorrow, but may the Lord forgive us for what we have done. Our celebration tonight is a travesty. We're honoring murderers.
Who's there?
First it was a gold coin, and then it turned into this neat piece of wood.
Oh, there's something different about this fog, Dan. It glows.
Who is that?
Dan, stay away from the door!
Around the neck, now more like a millstone, a plumbing stone, by God.
What are those clouds out there?
Someone get to 887 White Beach Lane. My son is trapped.
Stay away from the fog.
Ever since you picked me up, things have been going well. The clock broke, the window's been breaking, the weirdo at the door last night.
That isn't you.
I'm not so sure.
Mom, can I have a stomach pounder and a Coke?
I'm sorry that I didn't come for you. I know that sounds completely crazy.
Not right now, it doesn't.
Hi, this is Lauren Marie Taylor from Friday the 13th Part 2 and Girls Night Out. And you're listening to The Hysteria Continues.
And indeed you are. Welcome back to The Hysteria Continues, episode 125. And this time we're venturing into the fog. We'll be discussing whether or not this is in fact a slasher movie. Obviously it's not a slasher movie, but it's another listener pick. And who picked this one?
It's Rob Doyle.
Rob Doyle. Well, thank you, Rob Doyle. But we are excited to be talking about this. But yeah, we'll be talking about if there has any slasher leanings a little bit later.
I think, Rob is way off the mark with this one. As there is no slasher leanings to the fog, in my opinion.
I think there is.
Ooh.
Wow. Well, see,
Eric, it's on this one.
Oh, controversy. Well, we'll come on to that a little bit later. But before we do, we've had a little bit of a break since we recorded the last episode, so we may have had a chance to watch a few things. So let's start with Joseph. What have you been watching recently? Has anything caught your attention?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I've been watching kind of a marathon of the old Nickelodeon show, Are You Afraid of the Dark? I'd never really seen it before, so I was participating in like a rewatch thing. I've seen the first season so far. It's a little more miss than hit. It's kind of clunky, very dated, and some really bad acting here and there, and extremely Canadian. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but there's a few stories that are, you know, pretty good. Some slasher type stories. One in particular with a cigar-chomping clown that stalks kids at a carnival funhouse, that's really good. You know, but for the most part, it's just kind of, you know, it's too childlike. I don't know, I just, it needs like a little bit of an edge, but I understand, you know, since it's basically just for young adults. I wouldn't even say young adults, I'd say just for children. It's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but it's kind of neat to see, you know, a horror anthology, you know, kind of geared towards children in a way, I guess.
Okay.
I know Nathan's not, probably seen that. I doubt you and Eric have seen that, though.
No, what happens?
No. What about you, Nathan? Did you watch those when you were a kid?
I watched it when I was a lad, and I really liked them. I liked them when I was a kid. You know, I thought they were really great back then. I own all of them now, and I've gone back and rewatched them once in a while, and a lot of times I find myself just kind of laughing at what I thought was just so brilliant when I was like 10 or 11 years old.
So a bit like some of the movies you've made us watch.
like Joseph was saying, the clown story, for instance. Like when I was a kid, that story terrified me. But as an adult, it's not a bad story, but as an adult, I watch it and I'm like, okay, this is actually more funny than scary.
Yeah. There's one story with kind of an ape on Fright Night where these two kids are worried that their new neighbor vampires or vampires. So they do some investigating. Actually, that one held up very well, and I love the ending to that story. Do you remember that one, Nathan?
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, it's kind of.
What's the title of it? Do you remember?
I don't remember the title, but it's got a really neat ending. I really like the ending.
If you remember it, will you send it to me?
Yeah.
I'm curious. I might want to rewatch that one in that case. Because a lot of the stories, not a lot, but a few of them like to do the twist ending. And a lot of times you can see exactly where it's headed, like, way early. Of course, when I was a kid, I was like, oh, wow, I can't believe that. But now as an adult, I'm like... They kind of telegraph that.
I'd say out of a 13-episode season, I'd say it probably usually has, like, two good episodes, and the rest are just kind of eh. Like, a couple of them will have, like an edge to them. But, the rest is just kind of, very dated and very silly, unfortunately. But I'm still having fun, rewatching it. It's just kind of a – I never did watch it when it aired because I think I was probably, like, 2 or 3 years older than the target audience. But I don't know. I like a lot of those young adult books, like the Fear Street series. Is it R.A. Stine, I believe it is?
R.L. So, Stine. I love
R.L. Stine, yeah. Yeah. But
if you think about Fear Street's directed at young adults and one death, it's described pretty graphically on Fear Street. It's like at a camp, and there's like a pottery wheel, and the killer has basically taken one of the counselors and held her face down that pottery wheel until it like skins her face off. Yeah. I'm like, that's actually pretty graphic for like 13-year-olds who'd be reading those books.
Yeah, it reminds me of young adult novels like Lois Duncan, and so it's got kind of that aesthetic. But
the best young adult novel is Deadly Detention to me.
Oh yeah,
I love that book. Mm-hmm. It's so good.
Mm. Anyway. Lois Duncan passed away, didn't she?
About a week or so ago.
I did. I sort of read her obituary and said. She kind of bought a ticket and went to sit down and watch I Know What You Did Last Summer and was horrified by what they'd done to her book.
Because hers was a lot more tame than the movie itself.
Yeah. But she probably wasn't horrified by the money she made off it, but even so, it's kind of a... Yeah. Okay, well, I'd say it's not... I don't think we ever got those over this side of the pond, did we, Eric? Not on terrestrial TV.
Well, we're
TV,
probably too old, maybe. Justin, in fairness, that if they did appear on terrestrial TV...
Yes.
I was too busy dancing to China Crisis and Kajagoogoo, really, to be bothering with TV series of that nature.
Fair enough. Well, thank you, Joseph. Is there anything else?
Yeah, one more. There's a director who contacted me about 6 or 7 years ago. He had just made a slasher film called Scare Zone, and I'd meant to watch it. And I just never got around to it, but I saw it on Hulu. And I'm not sure if I mentioned this on the last show or the show before, but anyway, I saw it on Hulu. I was like, hey, there it is. I can finally watch it. And I really love this. It kind of reminded me a lot of something like April Fool's Day, where it has like the cast that are extremely likable. And it's really well made and has sort of the, the Slaughter Studios type of humor, but it's not mean spirited. It's more like a, lighthearted, ha ha kind of humor. Like I said, really well made, well shot. It's basically, these people are running like a haunted house, and they're trapped inside with a mad slasher, and it's a mystery. So you got to figure out who the murderer is. Took me, by surprise that, I didn't guess who the murderer was. So that, kudos on that. Just an all around kind of very low budget, but very fun movie. Something I'd highly recommend, certainly a lot better than a lot of stuff that's coming out lately. But you can definitely tell it was made on a budget. But, the set design itself is pretty well done. Like I said, very, very, very likable characters. So, that it gets, high marks for that. But, I'd definitely try to look into that one. It's called Scare Zone. If you haven't seen it or heard of it, it's a lot of fun.
Cool. Okay. Oh, thank you, Joseph. I don't think I've seen that one. So, but Eric and Nathan, I take it by your silence, you haven't seen it either?
No.
No. Never even heard of it, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Me either.
Okay. It is on Hulu, Nathan. I don't know if you guys get Hulu over there.
But... I'm actually glad because I like Hulu.
Yeah, me too. And as an aside, Nathan, you sound like you're in a tube or something.
You do sound like you're in a tube. Or a tube, as we'd say.
If you consider my office a tube.
That's a little better. It sounds like you were like really far away from the mic or something.
Well, the problem is that I had to go to the doctor recently because I got these swollen lymph nodes in my neck and it hurts to talk. So I'm just quiet.
Oh, okay. Anyway, that's all for me. That's all for me.
Eric, have you had any swollen glands recently?
Well, that would be saying there, no, wouldn't it, Justin? Wouldn't you like to know about my swollen glands?
Well, what have you been watching recently?
I've been watching absolutely nothing except for The Fog and also another film that we are working on that we can't mention. But I because I've been away on holidays, I've been to Portugal. So I've read a book that might be of interest. It's called Jaws 2, The Making of the Hollywood Sequel. Written by Louis Pisano and Michael Smith. This is a very apt place to read a book about the making of Jaws 2. I'd say it's the sort of lying on a sun-kissed beach in Portugal. So do you remember that Jamie Lee Curtis book that came out a few years ago? I think David Grove was the author, Justin. Do you remember that one? It was called Scream Queen. Yeah. Okay, this has similar issues in that it feels kind of like a rough draft. You'll read something and go, hang on, he said the exact same thing sort of 5 pages ago, and also there's lots of grammatical errors and lots of spelling errors, and it really could have done with maybe a few more drafts to give it that sort of professional sheen. But having said that, it's a really, really interesting read, because I don't know if you're familiar with the backstory of Jaws 2, but it started life as a John Hancock film. Of course, we would know him best for Let's Scare Jessica to Death. And he was fired after 4 weeks of shooting. And then the film went on a hiatus for about 2 months, where they completely rewrote the script. Lots of characters were dropped from the film. New ones were and certain roles recast. So what the authors have done is they've tracked down all the people who were in the original version of Jaws 2 and just asked them about their experience. And I mean, it must have been horrible to be, you know, signed up to do Jaws 2. And Jaws had, at that point in time, was the biggest grossing film of all time. And to think you're going to be in the sequel and then, you know, a month into shooting, you have the rug pulled from underneath you and say, no, sorry, we're not going to bother with you at all. We're, you know, getting rid of your role and we're restarting the film from scratch. It must have been horrendous. But the book is really interesting because it talks to about a dozen people who were on the original shoot who ended up being axed, including Ricky Schroeder, who was the original Sean Brody. And apparently his mum wasn't too impressed because he was blonde. But to make him look like Roy Scheider's son, they made him dye his hair brown. And then after a few weeks, they told him to go away. They were recasting him. So his mum wasn't impressed because she thought a blonde boy would have more job potential in the TV market. Apparently, Roy Scheider was an absolute cunt as well. And nobody has anything nice to say about him. Apparently, he was incredibly difficult to work with. And everyone was glad to see the back of him, which I would never have picked up on, because any films I see him in, he comes across as quite likable. But reading the background of the film, it's just astonishing that such a good and coherent movie came out of it, because when you read about the background, it should have turned out like Boarding House or something like that, or Skullduggery. But
if it had turned into one of those, it would have been even more amazing.
It probably would have been more amazing. Yes, it's true. That is true, in fairness. But like, for all the years I've watched Jaws 2, because it's a favorite film of mine, I would never have guessed that there was such production issues behind it until, you know, I found out maybe when the DVD came out 10 or 15 years ago that there was production issues going on behind the scenes. But you wouldn't pick up on it without knowing. I wouldn't anyway. But yeah, it's a really interesting read. I mean, as I said, it could do a more professional sheen maybe, but it's got tons of fascinating information in there, and they have tracked down practically everyone of note who was involved in the production of both sort of versions of Jaws 2, and it makes a very interesting read. It's called Jaws 2, The Making of the Hollywood Sequel.
Interesting. So, did any of that original footage ever surface?
As far as I know, no. A couple of shots of John Hancock's are in the final cut, but otherwise all that footage is missing in action or is in a vault somewhere. Some of the actors are asked if they got to see their dailies, you know, and they say no, they weren't allowed. One of the things in the book that is a bit of a disappointment is that there's tons of stills from the John Hancock original shoot, but they're quite poorly reproduced, and they're not on glossy paper, and they're very kind of low res. And it would have benefited, you know, if this had been a more professional product and had a big glossy sort of center section with all these stunning photographs from behind the scenes of the troubled production early in, you know, early on. So no John Hancock. There's an amazing DVD waiting to happen with Jaws 2. I just hope that someday it gets released.
Yeah, no, it's kind of that is interesting. So yeah, I'd love to see. It's funny. Well, it's not coincidentally, I kind of guess, but that we're going to be talking about another film later that went through some extensive reshoots.
Yes,
but not quite as disastrously as Jaws 2, by the sound of it. Although, obviously, it's amazing that Jaws 2 turned out to be such a fun movie.
It is. It's a great film, I think.
Yeah,
so, I prefer it to the original. I think I've said that before. Mm. You know, it plays to my tastes more than the original does.
Yeah, excellent. Is there anything else you've been watching?
No, that's. I'm trying to think back. No, I haven't seen anything horror-y since I left for my holidays. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Eric.
I did see an episode of Mrs. Brown's Boys, which was quite horrific.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah, that must be horrific. So, well, thank you, Eric. Nathan, do you want to talk a little bit about your garden?
Because my lawnmower is stolen by a fucking pig!
Nathan.
If you guys would stop growing rhubarb, then I wouldn't have to come over and take it.
Well... It's a joke that never grows old.
Never will.
Or maybe it never will.
But it's a new Allendale. But,
yeah.
But Nathan, have you been watching anything apart from rhubarb?
Yes, I have. Don't interrupt me.
Ooh.
I watched The Conjuring Part 2.
Oh, and was any good?
If you like the first one, then you'll probably like this one. I thought the first one was better. But this one is still good. I mean, it's still your typical ghost, you know, lots of jump scares, you know, that kind of thing. But, I mean, I really enjoyed it. I like the whole, like, dynamic between the ghost hunters, Ed and Lorraine Warren. I liked, their scenes in this one's really good. And this one actually has a really scary demon. It takes the form of a nun. And I'm like, that was actually a pretty scary scene in the film. Is any scene featuring that nun was really scary. But I don't want to say too much about it because it's still really new. But, I mean, I'd say if you like the first one, you should definitely go see the second one because it's kind of more of the same. But since I love the first one, I was hoping for that. So.
Hmm. Has anyone else seen The Conjuring 2?
No, because it opened when I was away, so I haven't really caught up yet. So.
No, Joseph, you were going to go and see it, weren't you? Or did you end up seeing it?
No, I'm a little ghosted out, so I'm having a hard time mustering up the enthusiasm, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. I was not pushed about The Conjuring, but I would be interested in seeing The Conjuring 2 for some reason. I don't know why. I haven't even seen that scary nun. So
I haven't even seen the first one yet. So.
No, have you not? All right.
No. Okay.
See, I'm not ghosted out. I'm zombied out at the moment, but I'm not ghosted out yet. So.
Well, I saw The Conjuring 2. I saw it at the cinema about a week and a half ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, and I enjoyed it well enough. I liked the first Conjuring, and this one was typically kind of over the top, considering it was set in Enfield in London in 1976 or 7. It was kind of what is it like? It does that kind of working class kind of council house Britain, 70s Britain. The attention to detail is amazing in the film. It looks incredible, although it's got the most dour looking 70s kind of council house you could imagine. I liked it. I mean, I thought the nun was good, although it just basically looks like a Marilyn Manson in a habit. Which kind of a thing, but there's some really good scares in it. There's some good jump scares. There was kind of a bizarre thing where they've got this kind of huge kind of basement underneath this kind of council house, which I don't think you would have ever had. It was
we don't have basements in this part of the world, do we? At all.
Well, Well, not in 1930s kind of, you know, sort of like in Enfield. I don't think they were built of this massive great big basement that then gets flooded and then but obviously gives loads of opportunity for ghostly things happening underneath. I mean, the things that kind of rankled me, I mean, it's great with the, obviously it's a whole fantasy thing, you know, Ed and Lorraine Warren, it's obviously not believe, you know, none of it's true. But it's very kind of like, it's very kind of pro-religious. I mean, it's very, you know, Christ will save us, that type of thing. And it's, whether or not, I don't know if James Wan is particularly religious, but it felt a little bit preachy to me. I mean, I suppose that's what Ed and Lorraine Warren were, essentially. But if you can view it as completely a fantasy film, which is essentially is that what it is, it's obviously based on a real case. Well, I say a real case, it's based on another fake, probably. I think it was like the Amityville haunting was kind of outed as being a fake eventually. So, but yeah, it's very well done. It's kind of does exactly what it says on the tin. You know, lots of jump scares, like spooky bits. But it's kind of, yeah, I think we are reaching burnout with these kinds of movies, I think. So be interesting to see where they go next. And I'm surprised actually James Wan came back and did it because didn't he was supposed to be going off and doing other stuff, wasn't he? And he did, didn't he do... Need for Speed. What are those films?
Fast and Furious 7. He did.
Fast, yeah. But obviously, what happened with that guy who died? Thingy Walker.
Paul Walker.
Paul Walker. It's probably kind of was probably a bit of a nightmare for him. So he's kind of come back to making scary movies. But yeah, it's perfectly watchable. It's a lot better than a lot of other films of its ilk. But it's not, you know, not going to win any awards, I don't think. But Nathan, is there anything else you watched?
I was curious about one thing. Do jump scares get you guys? Like, are you jumpy in general?
Yes.
Or I am. I'm very jumpy, so I jump just about at anything. So I was curious how they affect you.
Any kind of sudden loud noise will make me jump, regardless if it's a horror film or not.
It's very rare for that to happen to me these days. I can't remember the last movie that actually made me jump.
Was it The Exorcist 3?
Maybe.
I know that one made you jump, though.
Yeah, that one did. Of course, that was a long time ago as well. Yeah.
One thing that makes me jump the most probably is a skipping rope.
Oh, Eric.
Yeah. Is that your joke of the week?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my joke of the millennium, baby.
The millennium's far off.
No, yeah, but God. I'm just saying that there's not going to be a joke better than that between now and the year 3000.
Well, just prepare a good one for the year 3000.
I predict we'll all be alive by the year 3000. We'll find the fountain of youth or whatever it is.
We'll still be having Skype issues as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we're battling Skype issues at the moment, so bear with us. But yeah, I jump quite a lot in this film. I don't jump as much as other people, but I do. It did make me jump a few times. I mean, interestingly, but there's the scene in it. You probably know the one I mean, Nathan, with the it's got the kids' teepee, the tent.
Yes.
With the and then there's kind of like one of those what they called those things where you kind of spins around the light and then it looks like someone's animates a character.
Zoetrope. Crooked Man, isn't it?
Zoetrope.
Yes, that's right. Zoetrope, yeah. And then there's a scene in there that made me jump and everyone in the cinema really jumped. Going on from that, are you finished, Nathan? Because obviously I don't want to upset you. Oh, Nathan.
Nathan, calm down.
I don't like using like the F word that much.
Well, no, I know.
That clip tells a different story.
It does, right?
Well, I can't believe I used it. I think that I was, you know, under the influence of like some alcohol that Justin probably gave me, so it's kind of his fault.
Well, that could happen. And but are you finished, Nathan? Because I don't. It's a good job I checked, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I watched one that I liked even more than The Conjuring 2. I finally got a chance to watch 10 Cloverfield Lane, and I loved it. I thought it was so fantastic. And I will say that I preferred all the stuff in the bunker above what happens, you know, anything that happens outside the bunker.
I thought you would, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because in everything in that bunker, like John Goodman, his performance was fantastic. I mean, he just plays this character that kind of puts you on edge the whole movie because you don't know if he's going to snap or when or anything. I mean, he's very much like one of those people that's teetering between, you know, like crazy rage and then just being okay.
Kind of like Eric.
Hey!
But, I mean, yes. It's great. It's an awesome, awesome movie. I liked it better than the first one. I really, really, really enjoyed it.
I watched that again. I don't think it held up as well on the second viewing. I love the bunker stuff, but once we get outside and we find out what's really going on, I thought it just kind of lost some, you know, a lot of momentum. But you know, everything in the bunker is just fantastic, though. So it's still an effective movie.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, because to me, like, part of what made it so great is not knowing what was going on.
Yeah.
So I think if you rewatch it knowing what's going on, it kind of takes some of that suspense away.
Yeah.
But the first time, I mean, it was a great, great experience.
I loved the ending of 10 Cloverfield Lane.
I mean, I loved
that last 15 minutes.
I mean, I didn't hate it. I just thought it, I guess, to me, I guess I thought it didn't hold up as good as the stuff preceding it.
I haven't seen it yet, so I'm obviously waiting for it to come out legally.
I saw it in the cinema, I'll have you know.
It's legally available right now. It's on demand.
Is it? Well, not here, I don't think.
I pay $4.99 to watch it.
Excellent. As you should, Nathan.
As I should.
Film industry alive. Yeah. So, okay. Well, thank you. Maybe I'll chime in when I've seen it. Obviously, I haven't. So, anything else, Nathan? Obviously, again, I'm treading on eggshells here.
Exactly. The only thing left is I just wanted to whine about the fact that I really want to see the Purge election, and I'm not going to be able to see it this weekend. So,
oh, it got a dreadful review. I was reading one website, I think it was Blu-ray.com, gave it a dreadful review.
Yeah, Simon Abrams on Roger Ebert's site gave it a 1 out of 10. Of course, his review is more preachy about politics, which was kind of a no-no, but... I still want to see it because, I like the first two, and oh my God, I love Elizabeth Mitchell, so I have to see
Who's
it.
She?
She plays the politician that Frank Grillo has to protect.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. She I have nice like boobies. The idea behind it.
Oh yes, she does.
I think it'll be a fun movie, and I mean, I don't really go into these movies trying to read too much into them. So I just want a fun popcorn movie. That's all I care about. So
yeah, yeah.
You know, that's all that matters to me. I don't really care about the politics and the preachiness or anything like that.
Cool. Okay. Well, we shall find out. Hopefully, next time we speak, you would have had a chance to watch it. So, thank you, Nathan. Yeah. So the only things I've watched, the one thing that reminded me a little bit of The Conjuring 2 was the. I caught up finally with Paranormal Activity Ghost Dimension, which I've been waiting to come out on 3D Blu-ray on Love Film. So I finally got that through. For some reason, I didn't have it for ages. But it was definitely a case of diminishing returns, I think. Even the 3D didn't really save it.
I really liked it.
It was all right. Did you?
Yeah.
I thought it was all right, but it was nothing. It was just kind of... I didn't find it as... jumpy or scary as any of the previous ones, really. Certainly, I didn't think it was as good as, I think it was at part 4 or part 3, I can't remember. But there was a couple of scenes that I thought, you know, gave me, I thought were quite scary or gave me shivers with that kind of thing kind of appearing from somebody standing up behind them. But that whole thing of the little girl being threatened, blah, 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 poltergeist, blah, 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 being there, done that, blah, 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 you know. And did you see it in 3D?
No. But was the 3D any good? I just can't imagine 3D. A found footage movie in 3D being terribly effective.
Well, the trouble with the 3D was that, part of the trouble, not all the movie was in 3D. In fact, a lot of it wasn't in 3D. It was only when they pick up the camera and use the camera to film stuff that it was in 3D. So that was a bit of a problem. I mean, there were some good bits. Some of the 3D was really, really good, but I was just a bit meh about the whole thing, really. Which I even preferred the one that was the set in the what was it the touched ones or whatever it was
the touched ones the marked ones
the touched ones the marked ones that's
the Jimmy Savile documentary.
Yes, I think oh dear Eric, but yeah, so that I was a bit meh about that. The other, but it was a lot better than another film I watched, which I kind of got extraterrestrial that we got out, and it looked like right. It was going to be really good fun. But by the Vicious Brothers, who did, I should have known, they did the, what's it called? The one that's set in the asylum. I can't remember which ones. Do you know the one that's, they did two of them set in the asylum with the ghost hunters? Grave Encounters. And I thought, I didn't realise it was by them. And it started off, I thought, oh, this is going to be quite good. And it just had the most obnoxious kind of character in it, who was kept on going on about everything being gay and stuff like that, and just being in, you know, derogatory terms, and just being incredibly obnoxious. And he doesn't die quickly enough. In fact, it's one of the few movies of recent times where we just looked at each other, we were watching about two-thirds of the way through, and just said, look, should we stop this? It was just getting shriller and shriller, and it was amping up the action. But because I couldn't care less about any of the characters, who were all either like ciphers or really annoying or obnoxious, that we just thought, fuck it, and just turned it off. Anyone else had the misfortune to watch Extraterrestrial?
No. I don't know anything about it yet, but I thought the poster looked intriguing, but obviously, no.
Yeah, it's on Netflix here. I almost watched it, but I'm glad I didn't now. No, not that you mention it.
Yeah. It's just got that, I don't know, it's throw everything in the kitchen sink at it. I don't understand. We've talked about it so many times, but why can't they make films with characters who are sympathetic? Why can't you just have a film where a group of nice people go to a cabin? Mm. We have a bit of drama and maybe a bit of clashing, but do you have to have like obnoxious characters in these films?
Because nice people don't exist anymore. That's why.
Well, I mean, because I look at it, you know, like the classic 80s slashers that we love. I mean, it had characters that you liked, but I mean, they could pepper in like the bitchy characters like Wendy from Prom Night and Melissa from Friday the 13th Part 7. But the thing is, like those, they were so over the top bitchy, like it was just so outlandishly bitchy that like it was actually fun to watch them. So, but I mean, yeah. These characters, they're not fun to watch. I mean, they're just like, because to me, somebody like Wendy, I think she's, you know, she's obviously very bitchy, but she's not obnoxious to me about it. Mm. Like, she's just, you know, very stone cold. But like characters that like are just over the top obnoxious, like I find myself annoyed. I'm like, I feel like watching this movie, I'm like, I wouldn't hang out with these people. So why do I want to watch them? But like Friday the 13th, any of those movies, like a lot of the characters, I like them, so I'd hang out with them.
Yeah. It's just kind of, I don't know. It's it is a curse of modern horror movies, or sort of a lot of the kind of, you know, teen kind of horror movies, that type of thing. I mean, we've got downstairs, we're waiting to be watched, is Unfriended, which I hear. I remember, I think it was Patrick.
I liked Unfriended.
I love Unfriended.
Did you? I hated that movie.
Is that the one that was out last year? Because there was another one out this year that was the same.
It's the one that takes place all over Skype.
Yeah. I thought that was really good.
I did too. I thought it was so good.
I hated it.
Well, I'm intrigued, but I remember Patrick from Screen Queens when you watched it, saying he couldn't really understand why these people were friends because they all seemed to hate each other.
Yes.
What's the one that was out this year called?
Joseph, who said that? There was another one, wasn't there? But I can't remember. You were talking about it, Joseph, weren't you? You said there was another.
I don't remember. Skype, I don't
Facebook.
Know.
It came out here maybe 2 months ago. I didn't go see it, but it was the same exact same concept. Somebody's unfriended on Facebook, and
I have no idea.
And no. She commits suicide or something, and then comes back from beyond the grave or something.
Okay.
But with Unfriended, I bought these characters as friends because. When you watch what's happening in the movie, it's all in real time. And a lot of this stuff is they have secrets from each other. And when these secrets come out, then they start hating each other. But when they first get started, like most of them all like each other. I mean, you know, so I mean, like when the movie first starts, it seems like they're getting along. But then all this stuff starts happening and they start hating each other by the end of the movie. So I'm like, I thought that was a little bit more believable. It's not like they start out the movie, all of them on Skype. And it's like, God, I can't stand you or you. Or you.
Do you mean a bit like this podcast?
Is that how this is? Do we start out liking each other and then hate each other by the end of everyone?
Well, we haven't had the big falling out yet.
No,
we?
I like all you guys.
Yeah.
Even when y'all make fun of me.
When do we ever do that?
Well, you called me the vegetable.
Yes, well.
You guys are okay in small doses.
Yeah, well, thank you. I imagine that's what kidding. I imagine that's what our listeners think as well.
Yeah.
And certain people review our commentaries, who shall remain nameless. But
Eric screaming at magazines.
Yes. On the beach.
I just am picturing that in my head, and it's making me laugh.
Do you want to tell? Do you want to recount that for our dear listeners?
Well, I can't remember who. I can't remember the exact review. The name of the reviewer can I say the name of the magazine? I think I've just more or less have. Video Watchdog was reviewing, and it wasn't Tim Lucas this time. He was reviewing our commentary on Don't Go in the Woods Alone, and he was kind of upset that four people who had not seen the film in its initial theatrical run had been assigned to do this commentary track, whereas he had seen it on its initial theatrical run, and he felt he was more entitled to be contacted by. Is the Finnegar Syndrome we did that for?
Yeah.
He felt he had more rights to be sort of, you know, on the project than we did.
Go cry me a river.
Yeah.
So annoying. Talk to the hand. We sound like Bruce Palmer. I'm tired of people's jealousy. Like, it's stupid. Like, just get over it. If you want to do a commentary, then reach out to these companies. I mean, try, put yourself out there, do something. Don't sit there and review and say, oh, I think I could have done better, but I'm just going to sit here. I'm like, get out of here with that nonsense.
Totally. Wow. He's gone totally rhubarb.
Wow.
He's Inga.
I'm just not about the whining. I'm like, I cannot stand listening to other people whine about how, you know, they feel somebody else has it better. I'm like, if you think somebody else has it better, then do something. Do something about it.
Well, that's the motivational speech from Nathan today. So,
and I mean, I can handle bad reviews. I can, and I don't want people to think that like I get mad if I see bad reviews for our commentaries, because we've gotten a lot of bad reviews. It's fine, but it just bothers me when it's like, well, you know, I don't know why they're doing a commentary. I should be the one doing it, and I'm like, that's just petty. I'm like, just review the commentary. Just say you don't like it.
It's kind of like the I don't remember who it was, but the one guy who said because I think we didn't take. The particular film as serious as he did, that we shouldn't have done it. And Death by Invitation, I believe it was.
Yeah, Death by Invitation. Oh,
I can actually kind of, I can kind of agree that we probably should not have done that commentary.
We were out of our element on that.
But still, you know, we did what we could with, you know, the material we had, and I'd say,
It was a film none of us had ever seen before, none of us particularly liked, and then it was a film we could find no background information on, so it was difficult to fill that hour and a half.
It was kind of we almost had to do it because it was on with us, Savage Water, was it? Yeah.
Yeah, initially, yeah.
Still, just, you know, throwing out petty, you know, jealousy because, you know, you didn't get to do it. You know, that's silly.
Joseph, do you remember the guy that wrote Vinegar Syndrome on their page and said, if you let Hysteria Continues do more commentaries, I won't buy any more DVDs from you?
I think I got in an argument with him or something.
You did. It was hysterical because he just kept saying, I won't buy any more. And everybody kept saying, if you don't like them, like, you don't have to listen to them. I mean, nobody has to. I mean, I've got Blu-rays I've owned for years, and I've never listened to the commentaries on them. I'm like, so you don't have to listen to any special feature. So it's just weird. If you let them do it, I won't buy anymore. It just makes no sense to me.
It's very
strange. Which is kind of, I think he's in a minority because, you know, a lot of people buy a lot of their stuff because we're on there, not to toot our own horn or anything, but, you know.
Ooh. Well, we should be talking about commentaries. Obviously, there's a couple of commentaries we can't talk about yet, but are upcoming. But one we can talk about is Arrow very kindly sent us an advanced copy of Satan's Blade, which we've done a commentary for, which is out, I believe, on the 11th of July. Mm-hmm. So, so me and Eric have got ours. I imagine it'll take a few more days to get over to stateside. But it looks like a great release. In fact, actually, one of the things that's quite interesting about it, which is different from the Slasher video release that came out, is that they've got the full screen and also the widescreen version of the film on there, which I think it will be better, because I've always found it difficult when you're watching a full screen film on a you know, like a square on a widescreen TV. It always seems a bit odd anyway, doesn't it? So,
and that the full screen version of Satan's Blade has tons and tons of boom mics entering frame,
so it was clearly it was shot full frame but with a view of being masked off, wasn't it, for like a widescreen release. So
I love anamorphic like the 2351. I just think, you know, with all the widescreen TVs out today, I just think it looks so much better.
I quite like anamorphic widescreen. Ruined my joke, Nathan, by interrupting.
Oh, I know. That's bad. I should have done it to Justin, not to you. I apologize.
Can I re-say my? Can I do my joke again?
Is it your joke, Eric?
Yeah, it was my joke and my second joke in the Millennium. You said you liked anamorphic. I said I like Anna Lennox. Annie Lennox.
Oh dear.
I don't know who that is.
I'm glad he interrupted you.
Hate you all.
Annie Lennox. It's a.
Is she a singer?
It's a singer with the Eurythmics.
Yeah.
Oh, I've heard of the Eurythmics.
Isn't she a? Oh,
yeah,
no more
her.
I love you. Yeah, Annie Lennox. Okay. Yeah.
I thought a guy sang that.
Okay, well, that joke fell flat on its face.
As they all
Let's
do.
Let's move on. One last thing I saw, which is actually will take us nicely into the fog, because there is a connection there, is I rewatched Ghost Story from 1981.
All right.
Last week. What?
Love that movie.
Do you love it?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I do like it, but I mean, it's you know, I'm not wild about it. It was, but as if it's the connection, obviously, is John Houseman, who is one of the four old men who are haunted by the ghost of Alice Krieg, who plays the actress who plays the ghost of Alma, who comes back to haunt these men 50 years later. And there's quite a lot of good stuff in it. I love the Rob Bottin's special effects in the. I think it was Rob Bottin who did the special effects in this. But that kind of like ghastly image of the rotten corpse coming out of the car, sort of standing up in the car and walking out. And
the bridge scene was really good.
Yeah. There's loads of really good things in there. I like, you know, and I like Craig Wesson. I think he's really good. And you see his Winkle in it as well.
Oh.
As he falls to his death.
So shallow.
What?
Well, you're saying John Houseman because the narrator or the opening narrator in The Fog was named John. I can't remember the actor's name, but they called him. Didn't they call him John Houseman, or was it John Houseman?
That was John Houseman.
Yeah,
he's the opening narrator in The Fog.
Yeah.
But Eric, you were saying you're gonna shut the door and have a manic fap to the Long Good Friday the other day on Facebook.
I didn't have a chance to because commentary track. Research and the fog research have taken over, so the FAP will have to wait for later in the week. Yeah,
the kind of the things you have to sacrifice.
I know.
For this podcast, Eric.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Mind you, he'll still Bob Hoskins still be waiting for you.
He'll still be waiting for me in glorious high definition, and his shirt comes off in both films.
In glorious high definition.
Too soon.
Oh. Too soon. When's it ever going to be too soon? Not too soon.
The film, by the way, the film that's like Unfriended, that I don't think it's come out in the States yet. It's called Friend Request, and it came out in the cinemas here a few months ago.
I've never heard of that.
Okay,
actually, so
it's the same kind of setup as.
Well, it's quite often they do these films, don't they? They do they have like people get wind of these films and then start making them.
At Asylum. The same
time.
Yeah.
Asylum.
Mockbusters.
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Snakes on a Train. So,
exactly.
Transmorphers.
All those kind of...
our friend BTK, David Molay, he was talking about how there's a lot of movies he had ideas for that the Asylum should pick up. And one that made me burst out laughing was his take on the Toxic Avenger was called The Toxin Revenger. I guess so. I'm the only one who thought that was funny. Toxin Revenger. The Toxin. Revenger.
Oh.
They would be, yes, well,
yeah.
Who knows if they're going to, you know, are they still churning them out?
Yeah, they did one, they did one not too long ago. They did their own little take on the Pacific Rim called Atlantic Rim.
Yeah.
Right.
Very, very awful, very awful, you know, CGI effects, but they're kind of amusing in that aspect, but otherwise they're just, you know, cheap knockoffs.
Okay. We'll talk a little bit about cheap knockoffs and remakes, I'm sure, while you talk about The Fog. But should we go to the trailer? And then
yes.
Eric's going to talk to us, bring us in with his dulcet tones.
Yes.
It is night. It is cold. It is coming. The fear that lives.
in the fog. John Carpenter's The Fog. Give thanks it won't be here until next year. And for all those who can hear my voice, look into the darkness across the water. Look for the fog. Coming soon from AFCO Embassy Pictures.
Ahoy, mateys. It's DJ Sexy here, bringing you the smooth sounds of Toya and Ketchagugu for the next 3 hours on THC Radio. Oh, yeah. But first, let me give you the synopsis of The Fog. The sleepy seaside village of Antonio Bay is about to learn the true meaning of the word vengeance. This seemingly perfect town masks a guilty secret, a past steeped in greed and murder. Ahoy! Exactly 100 years ago, a ship was horribly wrecked under mysterious circumstances in a thick, eerie fog. Now shrouded in darkness, the long-dead mariners have returned from their watery grave to exact a bloody revenge. Now, let's listen to the 10-minute, 12-inch remix of It's a Mystery by Toya. You play it there for me now, Justin. You going to play
sorry,
it, Justin?
Sorry, that wasn't recording, sorry. Do it again. Not really.
Yes.
But hold on, let me see if that's where you
don't have to put it in now, but if you can put in that 10-minute Toya track afterwards, is that okay?
For some reason, I can't. My computer refuses to play
10 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, I might drop in a Susie track instead.
I knew you
That'd
would.
Be funny, wouldn't it?
Anyway.
Talking of foghorns, maybe we could play it. What?
Yeah, talking of foghorns, you could play Susie.
Well, we could see. We'll see.
Okay. Well,
anyway,
to me.
Anyway, carry on for goodness sake.
Well, I find this a delightfully straightforward horror film. As I said at the top of the podcast, I'm not sure about its slasher credentials. I'm sure Joseph will disagree. But I'll let that slide as it suits me to sort of talk about this movie as it's one I really like. I'm a big fan of John Carpenter's what I call golden era, which is everything he did from 1976's Assault on Precinct 13 up until 1987's Prince of Darkness. So within that sort of resume, I think The Fog is maybe slightly one of the lesser titles, but it's still an absolute cracker in my opinion. It's dripping with atmosphere, has a great cast, an eerie sort of motley crew of ghostly figures. And the film's not terribly gory, and I've always found it quite slight, which, you know, it makes it sound like a criticism, but it's not really. It's almost a cozy PG-13 type film, and it's like comfort horror to me. Like the only scene I think that earned it its 15s rating here in the UK and Ireland back in the day was probably the killing of the fisherman on the trawler towards the start of the film, which is quite brutal. But otherwise, it's. You know, as I said, fairly slight. Plot-wise, I mean, there isn't a huge amount going on, but again, the simplicity is part of the sort of the comfort horror charm that the film exudes. Now, I did say it was a lesser title in sort of the exemplary John Carpenter portfolio from the 70s and 80s, and one of the reasons I feel this way is that as wonderful as the cast are, I think they're kind of, a lot of them are underused. You know, there's just too many characters vying for time in what's a very short movie. I also find myself wanting to see more of Nancy Loomis's character, for example. I think when she's on screen, she's terrific. She has that Annie Brackett's like swagger that she had in Halloween and she brought into this film. You know, and I just always find it a shame she isn't given more to do. And, you know, even slightly larger roles like Tom Atkins, Jamie Lee Curtis, Janet Leigh, I think they're all diluted because there just isn't enough time to fit them all in. You know, only Adrian Barbeau as Stevie Wayne sort of gets the deserved screen time. Someone who shouldn't have had any screen time is the director himself, John Carpenter, who is hilariously bad as the church caretaker. I don't know if you guys would agree with me, but his delivery of, "Father, can I get paid?" It makes me chuckle every time. He reminds me of possibly like the storekeepers from The Mutilator, or, you know, that level of acting. And some of the locations in the film are just absolutely stunning, particularly the lighthouse. I love the shot of Stevie Wayne walking down the steps to the radio station, and she's carrying all her records, although it's incredibly gusty. And if that was me, I would fear for my Toya and Kajagoogoo collection. You know, they might get swept off into the sea by a gale force wind, never to be seen again, and that would upset me.
Wouldn't that be a tragedy?
That would be an absolute tragedy, Justin. I just have to compose myself. Even thinking about it, it's just overwhelming.
But, that's what I call a toxic waste still.
You sound like Rainier Wolfcastle with his one-liners.
Yes. That's the joke. Sorry.
And looking at, like, I have the Scream Factory Blu-ray of The Fog, and looking at the widescreen photography, it makes me wonder how on earth I managed to enjoy watching my old faded pan and scan print on VHS in the 1980s. Somehow I did manage to enjoy it, but John Carpenter's films were not treated well in the VHS era even. You know, I don't think I'll ever see a VHS release as bad as the Channel 5 copy of Halloween I had in the mid-80s, which was atrocious. You know, you really need to see his films in widescreen, and The Fog is a perfect example of why. It looks amazing from start to finish. So anyway, as I said, I think Carpenter has made half a dozen better movies than The Fog, but I still rate it very, very highly indeed. I think it's stunningly shot. It's got a degree of spookiness. As I said, I would refer to it as comfort horror. It's something I can return to over and over again, like Friday the 13th or Crazy Fat Ethel Part 2. It has a great cast, apart from John Carpenter. One thing I did notice when watching it last night, I don't know if anyone else will agree, is that Ty Mitchell, who plays the young boy in the film, looks very like Lucinda Dickey. Do you agree, Rhubarb Lady?
I don't know if I agree with that.
Okay, well, what are your thoughts on The Fog, Rhubarb Lady?
You know, since you picked me first, I'm going to overlook the Rhubarb Lady comment because I'm excited I got to go first. Yes. I love The Fog, and I was going to say the exact same thing you said about Nancy Loomis. I wanted to see more of her character. I loved her character in this film, and semi-spoiler alert, I was so excited that she survived because yay. As soon as I saw her and it's a John Carpenter movie, I'm like, oh, she's dead. Because he killed her off in Halloween. He killed her off in Assault on Precinct 13. I'm like, I really am excited that she actually got to survive in this movie. Even though she got her hair pulled.
She did get her hair pulled. And it looked very sore.
Yeah, I'm sure that hurt. But at least she survived. No, I really love The Fog. I love the music in it. And Adrienne Barbeau has this great voice for radio. You know, like when she's doing the radio scenes. Like, I'm like, oh, you know, she actually has a really, really good voice.
Her music's a bit boring, though.
Yeah. I think it's easy listening, you know. You know, and I loved her, like, you know, the scenes with the, you know, her being attacked at the radio station and, you know, on that. Because that's an awesome radio station. I'd love that job. I don't have the voice for it, but I'd love it. But no, I mean, The Fog's a really, really good movie. And actually, it's one of my favorite John Carpenter films. I think it's one of his more underrated films. I like it way better than something like Escape from New York. Is that John Carpenter? Did he do Escape from New York?
He did, yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's when he did after this, yeah.
I like The Fog a lot better than that one. But now, obviously, Halloween is still, you know, my favorite John Carpenter film. But no, I mean, The Fog is really good. I actually read the novelization for it a really long time ago, and that was a lot of fun as well, especially rewatching the film afterwards. I felt really sorry for the babysitter.
Mrs. Culbertz.
I mean, she was nice. So it kind of stinks when the really nice characters, you know, suffer untimely fate. But no, I mean, fantastic film. I really can't say anything bad about it. I love how you kind of see like all the different, it's almost like a few different stories going on in the town, you know, before I guess they kind of all come together. And of course, yeah, my favorite's going to be Nancy Loomis, any scene with Nancy Loomis in it. Because she has this perfect, like, smart ass kind of way of delivering her lines, but she's still very likable regardless. I'm supposed to be talking about The Fog, but I'm spending this whole time talking about Nancy Loomis. I guess that's how much I love her. What can I say? But no, yes, great movie. Well, not a slasher, but
Ty Mitchell does look like Lucinda Dickey. We can all agree on that.
Okay, we'll all agree on that.
Isn't that right, Joseph Henson?
Well, when my shipmates and I pull into port at sea, the first thing we like to do is watch The Fog.
But no, I'm a little on the fence about The Fog. I think it's very atmospheric and very well shot. That that 2.35:1 widescreen look just does it a lot of favors, you know, with the fog rolling in over the ocean. And I love, you know, Adrienne Barbeau's like radio station setup. She has that view of everything coming in, and then she also gets, you know, the updates from the weatherman, and it just gives that kind of that coastal nautical atmosphere that I really love in, you know, films like that. I love that kind of sleepy, gusty, you know, seaside town atmosphere. I think John Carpenter did a very good job, you know, capturing that with his photography. The problem I have with The Fog is that I think all the, you know, the story threads are so disparate from one another, that it just doesn't feel very cohesive. You know, sorry for all the Jamie Lee Curtis lovers out there, but I think she's just totally useless in this film. I mean, obviously she's, you know, marquee value at this point, but, you know, they could have axed her character and, you know, the movie, you know, still would have been fine on its own, you know, I don't know. I just think the structuring. Boo. I'll boo you. I think the structuring of the film could use a little more, you know, touch up. And I understand that, you know, there's some production issues going on, but I think it's more of a. I'd call it more style over substance. You know, and the substance itself is not terrible or anything. I just think it's it could have used a polish. But I do love Adrienne Barbeau as Stevie Wayne. I think Hal Holbrook is really good as Father Malone. I like the idea of these, 100 years ago, this shipwreck happened, and then the ghosts come back to kind of, you know, go after the descendants of, you know, the conspirators. I think that's a good idea. And a lot of this reminded me of... I'm not going to say it reminded me of that movie Scream from 1981, but the whole kind of the narration that that's done in that movie about the old sea captain, you know, having a wreck or coming into town and something bad happening. It reminded me a lot of that. So and I think that was effective in that movie, you know, as slow as that movie is. I think that telling in that movie was really good. So that, you know, the way they do that in this movie reminded me of that. And I liked that a lot. You know, I give it a 6 out of 10, you know, for the atmosphere alone, for Adrienne Barbeau. I think the missing points, you know, definitely goes towards more of the structuring and pacing. But, you know, not a bad movie, not my favorite Carpenter film. I wouldn't say by a long shot, but, you know, kind of a middle of the road Carpenter for me. So 5, 6 out of 10. Thumbs up, but with slight reservations.
Storyline needs a little touch-up work. My ass.
So anyway, the structuring needs touch-ups.
Yeah, my ass.
Your ass does need a touch-up.
Eric, did you like Maddie?
I like it when it's touched up. I did like Maddie. Yeah. Yeah. We're getting off on a tangent now. That's fine. That's 13.7. Anyway, what do you think of The Fog, Ghosty McGothface?
Well, I love The Fog. I've always loved The Fog. I think I've probably seen it too many times. And so it definitely falls into that kind of realm of comfort horror where it's like when you listen to a record that you know so many times, so well, that sometimes you end up not really hearing the music.
Like Anthem from Toya.
Well, I don't think I've ever heard that, but... I still love it. I mean, we watched it on the big screen in so much we projected it on the wall the other night, and it was it looks great. I do love the film. It's just, I'd say I have seen it so many times, it just seems it's a bit over familiar to me now. So I was trying to watch it with as fresh eyes as I possibly could, because I think I had watched it not that long ago. But I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I do remember, I'm old enough to remember, obviously not old enough to have seen the film when it came out of the cinema, but I do remember seeing the adverts for it on television back in 1980 or 81 when it got released in the UK. And it utilised all that, like, shut your doors, bolt your doors, shut your windows, the fog is coming, which is probably, when I watched it again, it was probably utilising Adrienne Barbeau's... when she's talking into the radio. And I think I also mentioned when I first saw it, I was disappointed it wasn't an adaptation of James Herbert's The Fog, you know, his kind of, it's sort of early 80s sort of not video nasty, but like kind of literary nasty, I kind of guess.
What was the premise of the novel?
I haven't read it for years. What I remember it was just like a fog or a mist that comes out when there's an earthquake in England, or like a crack in the, and it just basically turns people insane. Uh-huh. So in a fog, anyone who breathes in the fog becomes insane, and they do all sorts of. But there's just like lots of people, like the whole of Bournemouth walks into the sea and drowns themselves, or there's a particularly nasty bit with somebody having their cock chopped off with a pair of shears. I seem to remember, and but it's just typical for like
nobody
like,
wants that to happen.
Well, exactly. But for a 13-year-old boy, I was reading this thing, my goodness, they've made a film of this. My God, how are they going to do that? You know. And then when I actually saw it, then you know, I was disappointed not to see cocks being lopped off with shears. But there's all kind of things of like in London with people going mad, and you know, it was very apocalyptic and big scale. Which obviously that's not what the fog is. I mean, it's bigger scale than Halloween. If anything, what I think the film possibly suffers from. Is a kind of probably to do with the budget, but what I would have liked to have seen watching it back this time is all the stuff when the DJ is saying to his son, get out of the house and all this kind of thing. It's obviously going right across the town, but the town itself, everyone in the town, you see lots of people in the town doing the 100-year anniversary and all that, but once they disappear, they've all disappeared for good. You know, you see the fog rolling into the town, but you don't see any of the mayhem that ensues in the town or people listening to this, apart from the main characters actually listening to this kind of panicked DJ. And I thought that adding a bit of that in may have just made it slightly bigger scale. But it's a minor quibble because it's a great, great film. I mean, I mean, we'll talk about background obviously later, but I would obviously be interested to see the film as it was originally intended. And obviously it didn't work how it was originally intended, so there was a lot of reshoots. But so a lot of my favourite bits in the film are the thing that, which I also remember, that if you remember the film, it was probably film 1981, which is the BBC film show that's... so basically it's film 1981, film 1982, blah blah blah, but I remember seeing they showed the scene on that, and it was a scene where Jamie Lee Curtis has her back and it's in the morgue, and the guy gets sits up with his the dead sailor sits up and comes after with a scalpel, which was inserted as an extra shock effect, but I thought it was very kind of well done. Having said that, I think the film potentially, it's kind of some of the stuff, like all the kind of the stuff with chairs moving around and petrol pumps falling over and things like that. It kind of, I know it's all supernatural, but I'm not sure if that quite gels with the ghostly sailors coming back. But there's loads of great stuff in it. I do agree with Joseph to some degree that I think, I mean, I love Jamie Lee Curtis, and I like the fact that she became, you know, she was playing the mirror opposite of Laurie Strode by becoming, you know, being this sexually liberated kind of teenager in this, who sort of jumps into bed with, you know, the person she's hitchhiking with, and then sort of they, you know, have sex before even asking his name. And so that's great for her to do that. But ultimately, she's not actually given a massive amount to do in this film. And I would have liked to have seen her given more to do than she actually does. But the ensemble cast is great, and it's nice to see, you know, Janet Leigh in there. So summing up, it's just, I find it sort of, it's just one of those films I'm so familiar with, but I do love it. I've always loved The Fog. It's not as good as Halloween, you know, and I still prefer Halloween. But I prefer John Carpenter when he's making scary movies, as much as I like Escape from New York and Big Trouble in Little China and those kind of films. It's you know, he had a very deft touch working with Deborah Hill, and so, you know, they just don't make them like this anymore, which is, it's a real shame.
Yeah, I don't know why you're also down on Jamie Lee Curtis in The Fog. Boo to you all, boo! I say,
I'm not down on her, but it's, yeah, not down on her. It's just a shame she didn't. I thought she did perfectly well with what she's got to do, but she's not. I just think it was a shame given that Halloween had been such a big success, although, as obviously they mention quite often, that Halloween wasn't the runaway success. And I've got Scream Factory release of The Fog, and there's that great Jamie Lee Curtis mini interview. Well, not mini, but like a 10-15 minute interview with her. And she said that after making Halloween, she was expecting the phone to ring off the hook, but nobody called. And so they almost kind of wrote, it's like the, John Carpenter and Deborah Hill kind of wrote her into the script because they felt sorry for her.
That's the vibe I got, yeah.
That, yeah, and so it was almost, not that she was an afterthought, but, well, maybe she was a bit of an afterthought, that she wasn't the main focus for the film, and I think it showed. So I think what Joseph was saying is that you could have quite easily have not had her character in the film, because she's an outsider, she's not, has nothing to do with the town. And I think she's great with what she does, but she's not, it's you know, I think if they'd remade The Fog today, or if they you know, they possibly would have made her you know, or had to, in hindsight, they may have beefed up her character perhaps to do more than just kind of scream and look scared, basically.
Do we know what Jamie Lee Curtis thinks of The Fog? Cause I think,
yeah, I mean, she says she doesn't like it.
Oh, really? Because I know she hated Prom Night, right?
Well, the thing is, yeah, I always thought she hated Prom Night as well. But like on this interview that Justin was just mentioning on the Scream Factory disc, she goes through the sort of the five or six horror films she did around this time. She obviously loves Halloween. She says she doesn't really like The Fog, and she's not in it that much. And she says she doesn't really understand why it has a cult following. And then what she says about Prom Night and Terror Train, she says, oh, you know, they're kind of okay. They are what they are. And then she has really nice things to say about Halloween 2, which I was surprised about.
Oh.
She thinks it's a really strong sequel. She says there's loads of good stuff in it. And she likes, obviously, like, she likes Road Games as well, even though she's hardly in that film either. But yeah, so yeah, she's surprised that The Fog has a cult following because she doesn't think it's a terribly good movie.
Oh, okay.
But I don't, she's not completely dissing it. She's just being, she says, look, I'm just going to be honest with you. I just don't think it's a very good film. But like, she's famously not into horror films herself anyway, so.
She's very straight talking, isn't she?
Yeah.
If anything, Jamie Lee Curtis, she doesn't beat around the bush, as it were.
But, she's so the opposite of Laurie Strode.
Yeah, completely. Well, she said, didn't she? She said she actually liked this character. She said the character in The Fog was more like her in real life, and the wardrobe she's wearing in The Fog was kind of what she would be wearing. You know, Laurie Strode was not. People think of Jamie Lee Curtis as Laurie Strode, but Jamie Lee Curtis is the mirror opposite of Laurie Strode in a lot of ways. That she's, you know, doesn't no bullshit. You know,
I think of her as the aerobics instructor in Perfect, in really like neon lycra.
I want to see that movie. I've never seen it.
It's totally awesome.
I think I'd like it.
I think you would too. Yeah,
it's no aerobicide though, is it?
Well,
it's even better than aerobicide, if you can believe that. And murder.
One thing I did want, the other thing that I, is it just me, or did I, once I'd seen it, I couldn't unsee it. I couldn't stop kind of comparing it. But the lighthouse is much bigger inside than it is outside. It's like the TARDIS.
Like the TARDIS. I haven't really paid attention, but yeah, obviously the inside is a set and the outside is a practical.
Yeah. But it's kind of when you look at her walking in, it's she goes through, and it must be, I don't know, 12, 15 foot wide, the lighthouse itself, when she goes in. And when she goes upstairs, it's this kind of 40 foot wide kind of space. It's just always made me laugh a bit because it's kind of, it's very clearly this kind of, obviously it's a set and, you know, playing a dramatic license. But yeah, once I'd seen it, I couldn't stop seeing it. The other thing I noticed actually was there's all the kind of in-joke kind of things, obviously, with Tom Atkins playing Nick Castle, isn't he, his character, which of course was the actor who played the Shape, or the stuntman who played the Shape in Halloween. And also there's little touches, and I don't know if they're intentional, but there's kind of on the gas pump there was the name Bennett, and I don't know if Bennett's a type of make of a gas pump or a type of sort of a type of petrol or whatever, but they were talking, I think, the John Carpenter's character, isn't he called Bennett Tramer?
Yes, which is a hark back to Halloween as well, yeah.
It was sort of Ben Tramer. And then I thought, but then it's kind of weird that then it's Bennett on the gas pump as well.
I picked up on that as well. I was wondering if that was deliberate or not.
And you know, there's a character named Dick Baxter in The Fog too, and they make fun of him, Annie does, in the car in Halloween.
Yes, and there's a character called Tommy Wallace. Yes.
I would. Yeah.
I'm just going to say, yes, it's like full of in-jokes and stuff, and ties it very neatly to sort of Halloween and a few of the other works that, you know, John Carpenter did around this time.
But, yeah, I mean, I enjoy the film, but it's kind of, it's, yeah, I probably need to leave it a few more years now before I rewatch it.
Yeah,
it's,
I mean, not a film, yeah, I could, we were saying this with when we were doing Nightmare on Elm Street, there is that over-familiarity thing that does... You know, you can be quite weary watching these films, even though you know they're brilliant and they're ones that you love. But it can be, you know, as you say, it's like put on a record and just having it kind of in the background whilst you're doing something else. It's hard to sort of focus on a film like The Fog, even when you've seen it a million times.
Cool. Okay. Is there anything else we want to say about that before we move on to some background?
Yeah, can I just say that I think Ty Mitchell's character gets it all wrong. He comes running into his mother going... This gold coin turned into this neat piece of wood. And I'm like, that's not a fair trade. I want the gold coin. I don't want this bloody piece of wood.
Yeah.
Think of all the Blu-rays you could get for that gold coin.
Well, I know.
And Mars bars. Yeah.
You get a lot of Mars bars for that, I imagine. But, yeah, it was... yeah. I mean, did he go on to do anything else, that kid? Because I don't know if he was...
Well, he was the kid in Halloween 2 who has the razor blade stuck in his
face. Oh, right, he was. I recognised him.
He's been in a few roles in recent years, like as sort of, you know, bartender in club and, you know,
okay,
that type of thing. But no, he didn't go on to do anything major.
Okay, okay. I mean, do you want to... Should we talk a little bit about backgrounds? About
yes.
Because, again, it was kind of... It was a famously troubled... Well, not troubled shoot.
No, they realised it wasn't very good. Yeah. So do you have any background, Rhubarb Lady?
That's a no. No. F you.
Okay. He's totally turned into Rhubarb Lady
if
now.
If I was Rhubarb, I probably would have said the word. I'm not a goody two-shoes. Like, I don't...
You are. You're totally Jason Priestley.
I mean, I it's not like I never cuss. It's not, I guess it doesn't come naturally to me. But if I'm driving on the road, I have road rage really bad. So that's probably when I get all my cursing out, is when I'm on the road driving.
Or when you're stealing.
Do you swear at them, or do you sort of say F you? Do you use swear words?
F you, you horrible man.
Actually, I have used swear words when driving. I'm not as much like Grant, who substitutes words for swear words. I mean, he says fudge and stuff like that. You know, I mean, he rarely ever cusses. He always substitutes.
He's the TV version of the Rhubarb Lady.
Yeah. But, background, yes. I don't know.
Well, okay. That's okay. Joseph, do you have anything?
Yes. Let's see. The budget was an estimated $1 million, maybe a little over $1 million. In the States, it grossed around $21 million. Although it cost just over $1 million to make, Avco Embassy spent three times that amount on advertising and promotion. That included TV ads, radio ads, print ads, and the studio even installed fog machines. At a cost of around $350 each in the lobbies of selected cinemas where the film was showing. It was shot in 30 days from April 1979 to May 1979, I believe it was. I could be wrong on that. Let's see. At one point during the movie, Tom Atkins' character mentions Bodega Bay. It's a scene of another horror movie, The Birds. And incidentally, when Tippi Hedren's character pulls into town, all hell breaks loose. Like in this movie, when Jamie Lee Curtis pulls into town, all hell breaks loose. Let's see. Adrian Barbeau and John Carpenter were married at the time the film was made and released. He wrote the part for her specifically. The film's opening prologue was a quote from the final two lines of Edgar Allan Poe's poem, A Dream Within a Dream. It states, "Is all that we see or seem but a dream within a dream?"
Yes. Yes, it is.
I would agree. Adrian Barbeau and Jamie Lee Curtis, the leads, actually do not appear in any scenes together. And earlier we were talking about the jazzy, easy-listening music that Adrian Barbeau's character plays. The reason for this is because rock songs cost more to license, so they went with jazz instead because it was cheaper and they were obviously on a budget. That's pretty much all the background info I have.
Yeah, it's strange that because they were able to afford Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult for Halloween, but not anything mildly listenable for the Fog. Although Justin likes his elevator music, I think, don't you, Justin?
Hardly.
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 Do you have any background information you can give us then? Anything exciting?
Well, it's one thing I was going to mention as a slasher movie connection is the Hal Holbrook, who played the alcoholic priest in this film, which I related to him.
I was just thinking
quite
that,
a lot,
yeah.
And his struggles, but he was in The Scare Maker or Girls' Night Out in a couple of years later. He was also in Creepshow as well that year, 1982.
Wasn't he in Rituals as well? Was he?
Oh yes, he was, yeah. Wasn't he? Yeah. So he'd cut his teeth. He's still acting. He's 91 years old now.
Blame.
And he was in Sons of Anarchy, 5 episodes a couple of years ago, and it was a film last year. So yeah, he's still going. So that's all power to him. The film itself was there's a connection with this and Halloween 3 in so much that the inspiration, possibly for both films, came from a trip John Carpenter and Deborah Hill made to England when they promoting, I think it's Assault on Precinct 13, when they were a couple they were still a couple back then. And they visited Stonehenge and they saw a fog bank coming in, which was glowing or appeared to be glowing. And John Carpenter said to Deborah Hill, "I wonder what's in the fog." And so that's kind of the inspiration for this film, but also, I presume, although they haven't said explicitly, for the for Halloween 3, which is kind of revolves around kind of sort of black or magic from Stonehenge, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It was also apparently also inspired by a film called The Trollenberg Terror from 1958, which dealt with monsters hiding in clouds. I think Jamie Lee Curtis mentions that it was all a bit, well, I don't know, strained exactly, but Deborah Hill and John Carpenter, although they continued their professional relationship, had broken up by this point. And I think John Carpenter was in a relationship with Adrienne Barbeau, who he went on to marry. I'm not sure how long they were married for, but... what else? There was, I'd say, the reshoots happened when they kind of realised that it just wasn't scary. So John Carpenter kind of came back in, and I think with Deborah Hill, they realised, I think one of the films that kind of made them realise that times were moving very, very quickly, was although they were fans of What You Don't See Is Scarier, which is obviously what you saw a lot more of in Halloween, they went to see David Cronenberg's Scanners, and which was obviously very gory, and they realised that there was an appetite for gore, which again possibly would have been, although Friday the 13th wouldn't have been out when they made this, but they certainly would have been aware. Actually, funny, well, thinking about it, because Scanners didn't come out until 81, did it?
That's what I was thinking when they mentioned that on the extras. I'm thinking, did it possibly mean Dawn of the Dead, maybe?
Possibly, yeah. I'm thinking about it but she does basically say, I mean, what her main point was, I kind of guess, was they realised that audiences wanted slightly more visceral thrills and they wanted more blood and guts, and the mood was changing. So they kind of, with the reshoots, they added in a lot of the it's not a gory film by any stretch, because they say it only became a 15 here, and God knows you kind of like, you know, it's very, not very difficult to get an 18 certificate in the UK at that time, or an X certificate as it would have been. So, but they added in sort of like the kills on the boat, made them more graphic. The scene with Jamie Lee Curtis, and in fact, the whole of the opening scenes, the paranormal stuff happening in the town, were all added in. Plus, the prologue with John Houseman was all added in. So there must have been a fair amount of stuff that hit the cutting room floor. I haven't looked at the outtakes on the Blu-ray, Eric.
They're actually just bloopers rather than outtakes.
Right. Mm. Okay. So again, it's a shame. I mean, I don't know. I imagine, you know, if I was John Carpenter, I probably wouldn't want people to see my failed attempt to making a scary movie. So maybe, I don't know if he's sitting on those bits of film or not, but it would have been interesting to see that cut of film just for completion's sake, at the very least. At risk of going through everything, I'll pass it over to you, Eric, because I'm sure you've got quite a lot of stuff.
Well, no, I've only got small bit more than that. I was actually thinking, I was picked up on the Halloween 3 thing as well when they were talking about that, the trip to Stonehenge. I said, I wonder if that's what inspired Halloween 3, you know, would 5 years down the line. Let's see, what do I have here? Yeah, you were saying about the reshoots, and apparently a third of the final movie is from the reshoots. So we're only seeing kind of 60 minutes of the original production, and then sort of another 30 minutes of the reshoots. So as you say, there's probably tons of unseen material out there, which I would love to see, and I'm sure everyone would. But Jamie Lee Curtis was used to publicize the picture because when they started sort of making The Fog, Halloween hadn't become the huge hit. It had been quite successful, it hadn't become the huge sensation it was going on to be, because it was quite a slow process from Halloween being released to it becoming this international worldwide hit. So they didn't. I don't think they knew about the marquee value of Jamie Lee Curtis. But then, by the time The Fog was coming out, they used her as the poster girl, as such. Even though, as we've been saying, she really isn't the focus of the movie. And according to Joseph and Justin, she's completely expendable, apparently. So her character is actually named Elizabeth Solly. I don't get that her surname is mentioned in the actual film, but that's what she's credited as in the credits, and that's the name of an old girlfriend of John Carpenter's. Joseph, you mentioned that Bodega Bay is mentioned, but I think from what I gathered from the commentary, it's actually the same location from The Birds is used in The Fog when they're on the docks with Tom Atkins and Jamie Lee Curtis. That scene has in the background the restaurant that was famously used in The Birds. The spiral staircase in the lighthouse, well, apparently was taken from the set of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Mrs. Kobritz is named after the producer, Richard Kobritz, who Carpenter had just worked with on Someone's Watching Me, which was the film that introduced him to Adrienne Barbeau. And that homewrecker broke up his relationship with Deborah Hill. I'm just making up the homewrecker bit. They might have split up at that stage, I'm not sure. But I'm practicing to be a tabloid journalist, so... and Richard Kobritz also went on to produce Christine for John Carpenter. Darwin Justin makes an appearance in this. He was famously Napoleon, I can't remember his surname, I was keep thinking Napoleon Dynamite, but he's Napoleon something in Assault on Precinct 13. He's in this as the what you call the morgue people, the people who do autopsies.
Mortician?
He's the mortician, basically. And his character's name... Again, I don't know if it's mentioned in the actual film, but in the credits, he's credited as Dr. Fibes, which again is another nod to sort of classic horror films. Is it Vincent Price is Dr. Fibes?
Yes, yeah, he is. Yeah.
Nancy Loomis worked on the wardrobe of the movie. She like herself and Jamie Lee Curtis were very keen in the behind the scenes aspects of filmmaking, and so Nancy Loomis worked with the wardrobe department. And apparently the truck that Tom Atkins is driving is the same one that Donald Pleasence finds abandoned towards the start of Halloween. It's the one where he finds the Rabbit in Red matchbook. I can't remember what the name of the club was, but that's apparently it's the same truck. And I think that's all I really have for you that you haven't already mentioned, Justin. John Carpenter states EC Comics as a influence for the look of The Fog, which I can see. He was offered a two-picture deal by Avco Embassy, this being the first, the second one being Escape from New York, which came out in 1981. That's it, I'm afraid. That's all I have. Justin, can I get paid?
Okay, well, still battling kind of issues with various bits and pieces, but we're going to do some feedback in a minute. I'm just going to play the How to Get in Touch with the Show, and when we've done that, we'll come back with some feedback. So here we go.
Be sure to search for and like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at @THC_podcast. Our voicemail is 858-233-9281. And you can email us directly at the.hysteria.continues@gmail.com.
Okay, please do get in contact with the show. We always love to hear from you. Joseph, do you want to do a little bit of your usual kind of feedback from the Facebook group for this movie?
Sure, we have like so much, so I have to condense it a little bit because we're on kind of
borrowed time. This is Ben Schur. He says The Fog is one of the true horror epics. It's like Magnolia with ghosts. From the opening scene with everything going crazy in the town as Adrian does her late show, it is nonstop perfection. Also, the movie is still scary. Miles Hamer says, love you guys, but how on earth is The Fog a slasher? And we didn't really touch on this, but, I mean, the ghosts come in and they stab and hack at people. So, there you go. It's a slasher movie.
If you say
deal
so.
With it. deal with it, Eric. Anyhow, for what it's worth, I've never liked The Fog as much as I feel I should. Terrific, swarthy atmosphere and reliably excellent score, but it's clumsily paced, lacking in menace, and ironically, for a film about mist, disappointingly weightless. 4 out of 10. Bob Hartshorn says, like this one back in the day, but it's hardly stood the test of time. Visuals and music still stand tall, and it's certainly thick with eerie, misty atmosphere. But beyond that, it's slim pickings, I'm afraid. Despite the odd moment of tension, it's all quite limp and lifeless. With the weak on-screen storyline and Carpenter's squandering of the cast and his own disappointing cameo, via uniformly underwritten roles being amongst the top soggy sore points, he stretches credibility to breaking point, too, by explicitly suggesting that Jamie Lee Curtis would want to jump in the sack with Tom Atkins. Hell, would any sane woman, or man for that matter, want to bed this walking tin of dog meat? Wow, that's mean. Unbelievable. The Fog is certainly no stinker, but it's a long way from the once great director's best.
It's interesting to hear like the opposing viewpoints, isn't it? Even if you don't always agree with them, but it's good to hear. It almost sounds like he's got like a Nathan anger to it.
Tom Atkins is awesome. That's all I got to say.
The whole thing stinks of rhubarb.
Michael Tomlinson says, first horror film I ever saw, so has huge meaning for me. Wonderfully atmospheric, and I even traveled to the U.S. a few years ago to visit the lighthouse where it was filmed. Barbeau is magnificent. Mervyn Stevenson says, this was my very first horror movie, and I've been hooked ever since. Not sure if I'd call it a traditional slasher, maybe a supernatural slasher. The sense of dread that Carpenter was able to build with The Fog alone is fantastic. Lucas Gargis says, such an underrated film. I put it just below Halloween and The Thing as Carpenter's greatest films. The score is fantastic, the scares are genuine without an over-reliance of gore or cheap scares, and the film keeps the viewer guessing until that final great shot. Excellent movie. Scott Pliskin says, a Carpenter classic. Although, whoa, settle down. Anyway, He says, although I always found the radio station to be an odd operation, she's the only disc jockey at her station, so if she's not at work, people have to listen to static. And going up and down those stairs every day has to be a pain. The movie is very inspirational. That a 40-something guy like Tom Atkins can hook up with a 20-something woman like Jamie Lee Curtis gives us hope that anything is possible. Finally, Larry Liu says, Fog is definitely not a slasher, but gets a pass as the four of you covering it is a dream come true.
Hello?
Is that it?
Oh, no. Yeah, that's it.
Sorry, I thought you disappeared again. Sorry.
I was about to say, no, not again.
Not again. No, well, thank you to everyone who's written on the wall. It's always a good way to get the feedback in little snippets. But yeah, and it's interesting. Oh, hello? Who's there?
Someone is knocking at my door at 8 o'clock in the morning.
It's very fog-like.
Oh, it's scary.
This is reflecting the film. Art imitates life.
Yeah. Are you going to open it or not?
You guys go ahead. I'll be right back.
Oh, dear.
Okay.
God. We'll hear craziness
I have some feedback here.
Okay.
If you want me to read it out. This is from Shane Whitney. He says, hey, guys, greetings from Canada. Just wanted to drop a line to say hi. I just wanted to share a few things. First off, I recently checked in for an extended stay at Nathan's House of Pain. I sat through a marathon session of six of Nathan's picks that I'd never seen.
My goodness.
They are as follows: Blood Hook, Blood Lake, Movie House Massacre, Houseboat Horror, Terror at Ten Killer, and Boarding House. What an experience amazing. That was. The worst of the lot was easily Blood Lake. It would have been Houseboat Horror if not for Alan Dale's death scene. By the way, did you know that Alan Dale was in Neighbours? The most entertaining was Boarding House. What a hell of a good time. Good old Jim. One minute he's strutting around channeling his inner Hugh Hefner. The next he's coming back from the store looking like he just walked off the set of Urban Cowboy. Let's not forget the gardener who looks like Tommy Lee after a 2-week Coke binge. What a riot. Secondly, I recently re-listened to the Don't Panic episode where the Algonquin Round Table, remember that, was about tracking down obscure titles. I truly miss those days. However, I do have a film on my list that I'd very much like to see. Carnage Hall from 1988 is one I'd heard about long ago and I'd come to believe it was a fake title, much like Gory Graduation. Recently, I discovered that it is very much real, though, through the Facebook page for the upcoming 80 years of Stalk and Slash book. Would love to finally be able to see this film at some point. So here's hoping that the talk of a possible release is indeed true. I also want to say thanks, guys, for the hours of entertainment you provided so far, and I look forward to much more. I truly respect and love you guys, even you, Inga. I mean, sorry, even you, Rhubarb Lady. And keep up the great work. All the best, Shane Whitney.
Well, thank you, Shane.
Thank you, Shane.
I'm very excited that you got to enjoy those six films.
Gosh, that's it's kind of like it's equivalent of waterboarding, really, isn't it?
Completely, yeah. No, although I do agree that Boarding House is fun. Waterboarding House.
It's the equivalent of if there was a heaven, you get to go there for the length of those six films.
Well, let's we'll leave that there, shall we?
Yes.
But Joseph, did you return from the door?
Yeah, my landlord picked a very odd time to come pick up the rent.
Oh, right, okay. So, okay.
I thought it might be the parcel delivery man bringing you Satan's Blade.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish it was.
That's what we were hoping. But, well, thank you. Thank you for that. Shall I read? Well, Joseph, I know we've got to get ready for work shortly, haven't you? So did you want to read anything you've got, or...
Or have I don't you have anything.
You haven't got anything. Okay. Shall I? What about you, Nathan? Have you got anything?
No.
No. Okay. Well, I've got one here. It's a medium length one, so I'll dive straight in. It's hi, it's Dick Brown. Hope you're all very well. Haven't dropped you a line for a few weeks, but am enjoying all the great episodes as ever. I was somewhat taken aback during your recent one, though, when I discovered Eric is not a fan of the Carry On movies. Surely, when you were a nipper, you used to like them, Eric? I refuse to believe anyone on our side of the pond didn't used to get excited. One of them cropped off on the rainy Sunday afternoon. Actually, I'm quite interested to know whether or not Nathan or Joseph came across them over there too, or were they just preserve of our own now fractured isles? Eric, you've already said that you were kind of.
Well, see, I've never watched Carry On from start to finish. I've only seen bits and pieces, and what I have seen hasn't really done much for me. So,
But what about you guys in the States? Did you were you aware of Carry On movies?
Yes, we had. They would show a lot on a couple of channels, like in the mostly here, like in the early 90s. You know, I don't think I've ever actually watched a whole film. Mm. I've watched, you know, all the gag parts, which I thought are funny. I don't know if I'd be able to handle, you know, 90 minutes of that, though.
What about you, Nathan?
I'd never heard of them until I met you guys.
Well, there you go. It's an education, isn't it? But I know Benny Hill was always quite popular, wasn't he, in the States? And
yes,
Are You Being Served?
Was.
So, that answers that for Dick. But he carries on quickly. He says, anyway, this isn't very slasherific, is it? Sorry, I'll try and think of something a little more on point to talk about when I write... next. In the meantime, would you mind listing off the DVDs you've done commentary tracks for? I have Nail Gun Massacre, Graduation Day, Don't Go in the Woods, and that weird one set on a train. Have I still got any more I need to get? So...
Well, the wonderful Death by Invitation, for starters.
Yes, well, there's Savage Water, which is probably difficult to get hold of.
I have a list, actually, of all of them.
Mm.
Death by Invitation, Savage Water. They're on one DVD, but discontinued. We did Night Train to Terror for Vinegar Syndrome, Graduation Day for Vinegar Syndrome, Don't Go in the Woods for Vinegar Syndrome, Madman for Vinegar Syndrome, Nail Gun Massacre for 88 Films, Frightmare for Vinegar Syndrome, and currently Satan's Blade for Arrow Video.
And we have at least two more coming up, which we top secret. We're actually recording a top secret commentary. We shall hopefully be able to let you know what that's for next time. But watch the Facebook pages. And if you've got the list, Joseph, could you post it to the notes on the Facebook page, do you think?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. And there's also some of the other ones that I've done, obviously, a solo, without the rest of the baggage. I mean, my fellow podcasters. only joking. Love you, really. Kisses. Okay.
You're totally saying Malik.
No. It's always fun to do them with you. So, but yeah, looking forward to doing one tomorrow. Hopefully the Skype gods will be kind to us because they've been a little bit... you will try and cut out the worst of the problems this time. We haven't had any echoes, though, have we, since we
But it has been, like, I just had Skype cut out of me there a second ago. So I lost about 30 seconds of what you were saying, but...
Right, okay.
You're saying all nice things about me, I assume.
Oh, yeah, of course, yes. But as we are on borrowed time, I will say a fond adieu to everyone. But next time, Joseph, it's your pick. Do you want to tell the good listeners what we're going to be listening to next time?
Yes, in 2 weeks' time, we will be taking a trip to the supermarket for Intruder.
Yes, so, we'll be checking out forever. But, join us next time on The Hysteria Continues. And we're playing out with some music, are we, from The Fog, Eric?
Yeah, just some of John Carpenter's score from The Fog. I was I was assuming you were going to beat me to this punchline of saying, let's play out with some Foghorn music and then play some Toya. And I was saying, no, we'll play out with some Foghorn music by Susie and the Banshees. So as a happy medium, we'll just play out with some John Carpenter theme music from The Fog, because it is actually quite good.
Yes, exactly. It's one of the... In fact, actually, one thing we didn't mention just very quickly was that he redid the score completely, didn't he, to The Fog, as when...
did he?
Yeah, the score, when the original cut was done, he then redid the score completely, from top to bottom. So I don't know if the original score's ever turned up, but yeah, it's another little tidbit. But just one last thing, just to mention. Just give me a second. There's another podcast which I haven't listened to, but it's been recommended to me, and that is... Sorry, I did have it here, but it's just gone. It's The Girls on the Back Row, which is a podcast you listen to me. And they've just tweeted at me, Kate and Tab, said, binge listening to The Hysteria Continues while packing, thanks to a listener suggestion. It's awesome. So good to have you listening, Kate and Tab. And she'll be returning the favour very soon. So well, have a good rest of your weekend, everyone. And play out with some John Carpenter. And... see you next time. Say so goodbye to the good people.
Goodbye, good people, if you can hear me, if Skype doesn't cut out on me. Can I get paid?
It was a nude beach.
Hands on your hips.
It wasn't a nude beach.
It was a nude beach, Eric. Admit it.
I can hear Nathan having an orgasm. Hooray for Skype. Hello,
Justin,
are you there? Justin,
there?
Quit fooling around.
I think we've got a usable show in there. It's going to be like a bit of John Carpenter.
It's going to be a nightmare to edit.
It's totally going to be like Fog itself. Yes.